Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And I have a confession to make, and that's I'm a newbie with respect to public health. I come from an almost 20-year clinical background, the last 10 in cancer genetics. So what I've learned in the not quite year that I've been with the Office of Public Health Genomics is something that sort of surprised me, which is how much interest there is in genomics among those in public health. And I'm very pleased to learn that. So I mushed my disclosure slides together. No financial relationships, and you cannot hold the CDC accountable for anything I say today. So, all right. How many of you have heard of EGAP? Okay, probably at least half. So this was an initiative launched by the Office of Public Health Genomics in 2004. The evaluation of genomic applications in practice and prevention, and our office has a history of coming up with really cool acronyms, a lot of which include the word GAP in them, because we're trying to fill those gaps. So the purpose of EGAP is really to deal with this issue of so many genetic tests coming out so rapidly, very little oversight, lack of understanding by professionals and patients alike, and the need to review these and provide some sort of guidance regarding their usefulness. So this idea of knowledge synthesis and then taking that information, providing it in a way that we can translate it into practice. And it stemmed from an earlier project, also a CDC project called the ACE model, which is analytic validity, clinical utility, and ethical, legal, social issues. And this was a very detailed framework to provide guidance on evaluating genetic tests. And so it was based on this framework that the EGAP approach was developed. Now, basically, the bottom line is a genetic test useful? Does it improve the health of the individual? And typically, you cannot get from point A to that end question without going through an entire process, and that's what this EGAP approach is. So the overarching question is it clinically useful? Does it provide health benefits? But in order to get there, there's a step-by-step process. And the EGAP approach was trying to follow the pattern of USPSTF and other non-regulatory bodies, transparent, publicly accountable, based on very thorough, systematic, standardized evidence reviews, again, using the model of AHRQ and USPSTF, involving all of those that might have a stake in what is being said. So the experts develop the research, clinicians, agencies, policies, and other stakeholders, including laboratory personnel. There's an independent panel removed from the government that provides the recommendations based on the evidence, and always making sure that what those recommendations say are based on what the evidence told us. So again, in order to get to that end goal, we have to go through multiple steps. What are we dealing with? Define that particular condition that you're dealing with, but also the setting in which it occurs. And so there are tests that might have multiple applications in different clinical scenarios. There may be multiple different tests for the same medical condition. And in order to answer your questions, you really have to be specific on what you're talking about. So then we start with analytic validity, which is really what's happening in the lab. And the argument being is, can you really have clinical validity if you don't have analytic validity? So you're all very familiar with this. Can we accurately and reliably measure what we're trying to measure in terms of that genotype or that marker? Sensitivity, specificity, is the assay robust? And what about the quality control measures? And there's a lot of question on that. There's pop-up labs all over the place, and so it's very difficult sometimes to actually get this data because it might be proprietary from the laboratory standpoint. There's typically a fair amount of data on clinical validity, and this is often where, coming from the clinical world, clinicians tend to stop at clinical validity. You know, can it predict the disorder that I'm interested in? What about the sensitivity and specificity? And if the person tests positive, what's the likelihood they actually have the condition? And for a lot of the tests that are available, we have this information. But what we don't have is the next step, which is clinical utility. So we know that this identifying this particular marker, which makes this diagnosis, can be done, but does that matter? Just because that test is available, should we use it? And that's where the clinical utility comes in. And this is a real stumbling block because for many, 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 in fact, almost all of the genetic tests available, there really are not randomized controlled trials that are long-term studies that can look at outcome. But really, ultimately, this is what we need to be able to answer. And currently, the laboratories that are offering testing don't have any obligation to demonstrate clinical utility. So they can pretty much say the test identifies this condition, but they don't have to say, well, that's going to make a difference that we've shown that it impacts management, that then impacts the health of that individual. The other big thing here is weighing those benefits versus harms. You know, what, is this any value compared to not using the test? So last night we were talking about SNPs. Well, you have family history that might give you just as much, if not more, information than SNPs. So what is the added value to doing the SNPs? Effectiveness, efficacy, all the standard. But all of these issues then have to consider the contextual factors. So what is the prevalence? What is the severity of the disorder? Are there management options? You know, is this something that you could make the diagnosis but you can't do anything about it? Are there other ways that we can make that diagnosis without a laboratory test? How available is the test? And is it easy to use? How expensive is it? And then all your ELSI issues that come into play. So that's a really quick snapshot. What I would like to do is give an overview of three recommendations that have been published this year. There was a previous recommendation also published, but I wanted to highlight these three. And part of what I'm going to present are ways that we've tried to frame these recommendations to make them a little more understandable and useful to clinicians. And this has been a real challenge. I will also tell you that part of the translated materials that we're working on and developing are now going through health message testing and quite possibly are going to end up morphing significantly from what you see here today. But we're taking, you know, several hundred pages of evidence review that has been distilled down into a several-page recommendation statement, and we know what needs to happen in the clinic is, tell me in three sentences or less what this means and what I'm supposed to do about it. And that's a challenge. How do we stay true to the evidence, true to what the EGAP working group said, and yet provide it in a clinically useful way? So I feel I should start with a little bit of background on what these tests are about. I'm sure most of you are familiar with breast cancer gene expression profiles, but basically you're looking at expression of genes in the tumor that are part of the carcinogenic process. And it can give an idea of the disease prognosis. So which genes are activated or which genes are deactivated can give an idea of what's the likelihood that person will have a reoccurrence of their disease. Now, this is particularly important in breast cancer because we end up treating a lot of women with chemotherapy who don't need it. And that's because we don't know who needs it and who doesn't. And that's what the purpose of the gene expression profiles is to try to help us understand, does this person have a molecular profile of their tumor that says they will reoccur without chemotherapy? So our target population, women with stage one or two, it doesn't go beyond that because you get beyond stage two, you're automatically going to get chemotherapy. But there are other types of gene expression profiles that might be relevant to those later stage diagnoses as time goes on. It's prognostic. And then this is the summary statement from the EGAP working group. They found insufficient evidence. Okay, what does that mean? Well, we have to keep in mind that insufficient evidence, that statement, does not mean there's no value to the test. It is actually saying something when we say there's insufficient evidence to make a recommendation for or against. It means there's probably some data that suggests it might be useful in certain circumstances, but that we need more information. This is one mechanism we tried to use to summarize the evidence here. And what you can see in terms of the tests available is there was felt to be inadequate evidence under analytic validity. Part of that had to do with the fact that there are no really gold standard comparisons to determine activity level of genes in tumors. And part of it had to do with the proprietary nature of some of this data. Two of these had very adequate clinical data, and again, most of you know that Oncotype DX is very, very widely used, and it is based on the fact that there are some good studies showing clinical validity, but it really broke down when we got into clinical utility and particularly into cost effectiveness As a cancer genetic counselor, it used to irritate me that I'd have to fight tooth and nail to get BRCA1 and 2 testing paid for at $3,100, but the insurance companies are jumping at breast cancer gene expression profiling with no proof of its utility, and it's also $3,000, so it doesn't always make sense. So one of the things that I think is most helpful that the EGAP working group provides is considerations for practice, and we try to tease out these that might be most helpful to clinicians. So there is some preliminary evidence of benefit that we can reduce these adverse events in women that may not need the chemotherapy. But the real concern came is that we don't know about this. So what if we didn't give a woman chemotherapy and she has a recurrence and dies? You know, how do you weigh those benefits? And we don't have those answers. It's not saying it should never be used, but it should be used very, very carefully with appropriate counseling of the risks and benefits and limitations. The other piece that the working group provides that I think is very helpful are research gaps. And again, this is not comprehensive in terms of defining all of the research gaps, but pulling out those that might be most relevant to clinicians, saying, hey, there are some trials undergoing. We might have some of the utility questions answered. To me, this one is really, really important and probably relevant to this audience is, you know, how do these women use this information in making decisions? And what are the management algorithms using these? So that's breast cancer gene expression profiling, moving to a different type of test, pharmacogenomic testing, looking for changes in the UGT1A1 gene. And this basically produces a protein that breaks down irinotecan, which is used to treat metastatic colorectal cancer. Two very common variants. The 28 variant, if you have that, basically you don't break down that irinotecan as fast, and so it stays in the system longer. And it's what produces what we call slow metabolism. And that means you increase your risk for side effects, but you also may improve your tumor response rate. But it may mean that you treat people differently, different amounts, different drugs, different lengths of time. So again, we found currently insufficient evidence. Again, what does that really mean? Well, you can see in this situation, we actually had pretty good evidence of both analytic validity and clinical validity, but it broke down with clinical utility. So how you might look at this might be different than if there was inadequate evidence for analytic validity and only adequate evidence for clinical validity. Again, situations, it means it should never be used or can't be used, but it may be of benefit in individual cases when used by practitioners knowledgeable, and that's, I think, one of the real keys. I think there's a lack of understanding among clinicians on how this is relevant and how to counsel patients about the application. So if you have a patient that wants to be aggressively treated then and they're rapid metabolizers, then you may have to up their dose. If you have somebody who is, and again, this is metastatic colon cancer, so they may be making decisions on, you know what, give me a lower dose or give me an alternate drug, even if it may shorten my life by a few months. Research gaps here. Yeah, I'm not going to read all those, but you can see the kind of things that the EGAP working group identifies in terms of research gaps. So Lynch syndrome, also known as hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer, or HNPCC, most of you are at least somewhat familiar with this. It's a dominant hereditary cancer syndrome. Counts, though, for about 3% of all colorectal cancers, which is, given how frequent colorectal cancer is, that means a lot of people. Substantial lifetime risk, early age of onset, and associated with multiple other cancers. The target population here was looking at all individuals with newly diagnosed colorectal cancer. It was diagnostic, and in this case, they found sufficient evidence. But what I will point out is they found sufficient evidence that it can reduce morbidity and mortality in relatives. And this becomes a little bit problematic in terms of trying to apply this. Are you going to get an insurance company to pay for a test that is not for the benefit of that individual, but for the benefit of their relatives? Okay. So a little bit of a catch-22. This is another type of model that we use to illustrate here. This is looking at increasing convincingness of the evidence to demonstrate these factors. Again, analytic validity, clinical validity and clinical utility, adequate to convincing depending on which particular test you were looking at. All of these combined led to this moderate level of certainty that it could be a net health benefit to relatives. We also consider contextual factors, what are the management options, what is the cost, et cetera, and so forth. And that led to the conclusion that it is potentially beneficial to relatives. So we got a positive recommendation. How do we implement it? And again, multiple challenges exist. So everybody should be offered counseling and education materials. What are those counseling and education materials? Who provides that information? And this is a real, real stumbling block, and I don't have time to go into all the genetic testing strategies for Lynch syndrome, but there are preliminary testing on tumor markers that can be done that can help guide you which gene to test for. You can do direct gene testing. There's cascade testing. And this is where the data sort of broke down in terms of providing guidance. And that's become a real stumbling block in our feedback from the providers on our health message testing is, okay, but you're telling me to do it, but you're not giving me the strategy to do it. So how do we deal with that? The other thing that we tried to point out is that there are insufficient evidence to say that if you diagnose that person with colorectal cancer with Lynch syndrome, that you're going to change that person's treatment in terms of chemotherapy or whatever. However, there is an argument for the potential benefit to that individual in terms of risk for additional cancers, particularly colorectal cancer. And so that may be a leeway in the argument to get coverage. The other thing that caused a little bit of turmoil with this recommendation is they said that family history should not be used to exclude individuals. Well, that was somewhat taken out of context. That means we should ignore family history now when it comes to colorectal cancer risk. It's not what we're saying. It's saying that in terms of identifying individuals with Lynch syndrome, family history is not as good a discriminatory tool as some of the laboratory testing. However, family history still is really important for that whole unaffected segment of the population to determine if there might be Lynch syndrome in their family or if they might be at increased risk for colorectal cancer. We still have research gaps, and I think particularly regarding the various testing strategies, and we need more information on the clinical utility, cost effectiveness, and particularly how it potentially alters the clinical care of patients with Lynch syndrome. So what are the public health implications here? And you can help me with this. Again, I'm a newbie in this regard. These are a little bit lengthy, but there are existing colorectal cancer screening programs, and potentially we can include information about Lynch syndrome in these programs about colorectal cancer awareness and screening, including the educational activities for both consumers and providers. Educating the public health workforce about the importance of Lynch syndrome, and I would argue in this context that we can't just focus on the EGAP recommendations, but also bring in that importance of family history as well. So there's the people with newly diagnosed colorectal cancer, there's the unaffected people with a positive family history. And then surveillance. And this is going on in some of our collaborative states with their cancer registries. But you know, how many new colon cancers are there? This could potentially determine what level of impact it might have. What healthcare facilities actually have the infrastructure to deal with this? And there's a lot of facilities out there trying to look at early implementation. And then how do we monitor who gets testing, what those outcomes were? But I think even more importantly, if the purpose was for the benefit of the relatives, then we have to go beyond and say, okay, did that person actually inform their relatives, and did the relatives actually get tested? In other words, what we said was the good thing to happen about it, did that actually occur? And then the whole disparities issue. So I hope that gave you a little bit of insight into EGAP. Obviously, it's a very long, complicated process, and that's difficult in terms of rolling out recommendations as new tests become available. You're welcome to go to the website. There's lots of very, very helpful information. We do not yet have translated materials up here, but hopefully that will happen within the next few months. So we'll see. And I just wanted to close, here's a seat, GAPNet. I told you we like these acronyms, but hopefully GAPNet, which is a larger collaboration that feeds all of these pieces in, what do we know, what we don't know, so the evidence, the collection of that knowledge, building EGAP-like recommendations. how do we make those implementation strategies? And then where the public health piece comes in most strongly is translation programs. So this network that is newly being developed will hopefully streamline the way in which we can not only develop EGOP-like recommendations, but get them into translation and practice. So thank you very much.